squibbling rivalry.
By the hammer of Thor.
Great Odin's Raven.
Welcome back to Squibbling Rivalry with your hosts,
Ian Walter
and Lady Victoire.
We did want to kick off our Squibbling Rivalry segment, and we might be getting into some spoilers down the road for the Terminator franchise, as well as perhaps even some more Star Wars talk. So let's get this D20 rolling, and I think I'm going to get going first. So no peeky. Do I have a great squibbling rivalry for you? And it's going to work on so many levels. So let's just take a quick look here. And I need another D20 just to pick what movie I'm going to pick. That's how many movies I could choose from this.
Jeez. Yeah. That's tough. I'll have a good year.
Yeah, so this is going to be fun for sure. I'm just looking, and I want to pick one that's maybe not as obvious. As I've mentioned in the past, some of these movies are way too obvious if you just start anything you say about them, make it obvious. So I'm going to pull another fantastic quote, as I've done in the past.
All right.
Are you ready for this one?
Yes.
Stop trying to hit me and hit me.
Oh, my God.
And if that's not enough, this is a game changer. It totally revolutionized the way that films, at least action films, are made. And it's sci-fi.
I don't know. Is it Predator? No.
I'm going to give you one more clue.
I don't know it.
Stop
trying to hit me and hit me.
And it's going to be...
Is it... Oh, sorry. Is it Jurassic Park?
No.
Sounded a lot.
So a lot of times inside Squibbling Rivalry, we like to sort of go off on tangents. You might say we'd go down a rabbit hole or follow the white rabbit.
Oh, God.
And
I'm so lost.
If you know anything about what I've been studying recently, it might give you a hint. Some green-colored zeros and ones on the screen.
Okay, so... What?
I know Kung Fu.
I'm never going to get it. My brain's not awake.
Because I do... Like I said before, part of the fun is just trying to get you to guess the year, but I need you to at least land on the film. It's fine if you don't, but I'm going to help you out. And it's going to be... Mr. Anderson. Do you know who Hugo Weaving is?
No.
Do you know who Keanu Reeves is?
Oh, Matrix. Oh, Jesus.
I tried to get
you
there.
That's one that I never liked. I'm the worst. I'll try and get into it again.
Okay, so when's the last time you saw The Matrix?
Like the last time I saw Terminator. Other than yesterday.
You're faster than this. Don't think you are. Know you are.
Come on, stop trying to hit me and hit me.
I don't believe it.
What you're trying to do?
I'm trying to free your mind, Neo, but I can only show you the door. You're the one that has to walk through it.
Okay, so do you have a guess on the year?
1996.
Good guess. I've often touted 1996 as being a huge year for blockbusters. The only bigger year I can think of inside of the 90s would be 1999. The very last roll on the D20.
Oh, man.
The big 19.
Okay, that shouldn't have been hard.
The Matrix, whether you love it or hate it, you can't deny its impact on pop culture and how action films are reimagined inside of, you know, those slow motion scenes with anytime you're having a fight scene and the action slows right down so you can kind of dodge bullets or jump off walls.
And,
I think The Matrix has, on a conceptual level, it's epic, and it also has some of the groundbreaking, you know, filmmaking movie magic of the late 90s or even early 2000s.
Oh, I feel like I'm going to lose respect from some people for not getting that one.
Well, I am going to award you the point for getting there eventually, but obviously you didn't land on the year.
Just to sort of revise
the scoring, I know that I had mentioned in the previous episode that I finished October with 6-4, when in reality it was more like 5-4, because for some reason I'm giving myself 2 points for that softball you served me on my birthday episode, but really it was only worth 1 point because I realized after the fact that I didn't guess Star Wars. You gave me Star Wars as part of the question, and I guessed the year, so I really only get 1 point there.
All right.
And if we were looking at the points going forward, I mean, we each got a pair of points in the last episode, and now you just got a point, so that would make us tied
for now.
Yeah.
All right. Give me the die.
All right.
It's time to rival you. Squibbling.
Squibbling rivalry.
Don't look. He's looking.
I'm not peeking. Okay, cool. And another film from 1999, actually. November 8th, 1999. The World Is Not Enough. The 19th Ooh. James Bond film starring Pierce Brosnan. Robert Carlyle, our boy. Yeah. Denise Richards. And, of course, Robbie Coltrane, who we know is...
Wow, Scottish.
Scottish and Hagrid.
And Northern English Hagrid.
You're a wizard, Harry. It's more Batman than Hagrid, but maybe a little better than the first impression I tried. So you've rolled your D20.
I have. It's just too...
Is it a funky year, I'm guessing, maybe?
It's just so many good... Or is it a tough decision? Basically, I have so many funny quotes... But anyway, I'm going to give you one, and you're probably going to get it.
And you know what? I was thinking, because you were kind of struggling with The Matrix, and it kind of makes me sad inside my chest.
Oh, no.
So in this kind of theme of revisiting classics, and whether or not they're classics in your mind, they are classics in definitely my mind, and probably I'm not alone. I was thinking... This whole squibbling rivalry segment, it kind of revolves around 1980 through 1999. And we know there are films that we'd like to revisit. There's some, I think we mentioned you hadn't seen The Shining, right?
Yeah.
So 1980 is sort of the bottom, as far back as it goes in terms of the squibbling rivalry segment. And then The Matrix is kind of on that cusp of 1999, kind of the upper limit of where we're hitting in terms of the classics. Mm-hmm. So... Wouldn't it be fun if we were to try and set a kind of a goal or some sort of mission for heading into 2020 and trying to nail maybe watching a movie inside of each year that we've been rolling in the D20?
Yeah, that is a good goal.
If you were to try and watch something like The Shining, that would cross off 1980,
yeah.
And you could work your way through the 80s. Maybe I will start at the end, and we can kind of both watch these as we go through, but I could kind of work backwards from 1999 because I want to go back and watch The Matrix. Maybe I'll make you watch The Matrix and we'll kind of meet somewhere in the middle.
Well, that's the thing about doing the podcast. There's so many movies that I'm like, oh, I have to watch that. You know, there's not enough time in the world to have seen all these. And I wasn't even living in 1980. So, but yes, there are so many I want to watch. And that's the exciting part about this 20-sided die.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, we've got 2020 vision heading into next year. And I think... A year should be sufficient time to try and knock down 20 movies. It's a challenge, but we can definitely try and hit it.
All right, so I'm going to feed you some lines from obscure to more obvious, and you can just call it out.
I'm
going
to nail it on the first one. Just so that
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
What was it we had for dinner tonight? Well, we had a choice of steak or fish. Yes, I remember I had lasagna.
Lasagna. Oh, no. Love me some lasagna.
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit amphetamines again.
Wow, there's a lot of those.
I know. Joey, have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Can you fly this plane and land it? Surely you can't be serious. I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Are you kidding me? It took the most, I won't say it, epic line of... of that airplane exclamation mark film from, and I'm going to get an extra point here, 1980.
Yep, killing it.
Nailed it. So yeah, that's a great comedy, classic comedy, and those lines weren't resonating with me, but as soon as you hit the...
It's because they were random, for sure.
I mean, don't call me Shirley. Who doesn't know that line, right? So
yeah.
Definitely a great classic from 1980. And that would be climbing up there. So it's funny. We've hit at least five 1980 films now.
I know. I keep rolling that
20. Empire Strikes Back. We got The Shining. Mm-hmm. I mentioned Caddyshack, but we also rolled Blues Brothers and now Airplane.
It's a good year for comedy anyway.
Yeah, and a great thing too. I mean, we have lots to pull from if we wanted to start down this challenge for 2020. We want to start a movie from 1980. I'm thinking, leaning maybe towards The Shining, but it is your call because... I'm going to be looking at 1999 as you start 1980 and work forward.
Yeah.
Well, that was a great segment of Squibbling Rivalry, and we'll take a short break, and we'll get right back with some spoilery Terminator talk.
The stewardess said both pilots.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Doctor, I've checked everyone. Mr. Stryker's the only one.
What flying experience have you had?
Oh, I flew single-engine fighters in the Air Force, but this plane has four engines. It's an entirely different kind of flying, altogether.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
Besides, I haven't touched any kind of plane in 6 years.
Mr. Stryker, I know nothing about flying, but there's one thing I do know. You're the only one on this plane who can possibly fly it. You're the only chance we've got.
We're back. Lovely. Okay, so today, everyone, we're into November with snow. It's cold.
Some other cool things I've been looking at with regards to today, November 8th, would be the birth of, I would say, one of my favorite spirits. And not the one you might automatically think. So which spirit do you think I'm referring to? When it comes to favorite alcohols?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's some that are obvious given our heritage. But there was one that was born on this very day, November 8th, in 1789.
Like a brand or the actual spirit?
Like the first time this type of alcohol was created.
1789?
Yeah. I'll give you a hint. It was in the States.
Oh, well. I would say then bourbon.
Right you are. So Kentucky bourbon. The first one was distilled from corn by Elijah Craig in Bourbon, Kentucky on November 8th, 1789. And again, I'm just kind of... looking at significant events and birthdays from November 8th, as we have been in the past on Squibbling Rivalry. And I thought that was an interesting one because I love me some bourbon. What about you, sis?
I actually don't love bourbon. I'd prefer scotch or Irish whiskey.
So it's interesting you say that. I obviously, scotch is like the default. Don't get me wrong. I love me some scotch. Scotch, scotch, scotch. I love scotch.
Scotchy, scotch, scotch.
Here it goes down into my belly. No quality Anchorman reference there. But I love scotch, but the thing with me is that it's not something that I would want to order every time or drink sort of more casually. Like, it's something I want to sit down and really, like, get into, like a good book or a good film. if it's just like going out for a beer, I throw back a bourbon just like I could throw back a beer. But if I'm gonna go with scotch, I wanna like sit and enjoy it.
I see.
I'm not like running around scotching the rocks or something.
I see. Yeah, bourbon just has like the, I think it's the sweetness of it. There's some weird taste that I can't.
Well, and I love me an old fashioned too. So.
Yeah.
Just call me old fashioned. so that was a fun one, and you know, we mentioned the vampires, but some other birthdays out there.
Oh, one of my favorite female comedians.
Are we talking Parker Posey?
Yeah.
Wow.
Fry like bacon, bitches.
Yeah. November 8th, 1968. And then here's a funny little thing, because, again, it's not always about the person. It's just about the situation surrounding the person. Mm-hmm. But I thought this would be funny. So hold on one sec. this one. Oh, okay. So you mentioned Parker Posey, 1968. November 8, 1975 was Tara Reid.
Yeah.
Now, do we know who Tara Reid was? Because I thought it'd be fun to kind of go back and forth trying to remember on who she is. Is she like my boss's daughter, or is she...
or she's got it all, man. American Pie.
I mean, I think you're just taking body shots at her now. I think I remember her like from something like The Big Lebowski, or maybe she's just an urban legend.
I don't know. Isn't she also Sharknado?
I can't believe that. When I looked into that, I was like, wait a second. So she's in a TV movie called Sharknado, and I actually remember that TV movie. But what I didn't remember was how many of them they made and how she's many of them she's in. She's in every single Sharknado that's ever existed.
Also, weird coincidence there. Parker Posey and Tara Reid are both in Josie and the Pussycats. An epic movie, if Whoa. You ask me.
And, of course, American Pie series. She wasn't in American Wedding, but she was in American Pie, American Pie 2, and American Reunion.
Not Parker. Oh, you're just talking about
Tara Reid. Yeah. But yeah, they're both, you're right. They're both in Josie and the Pussycats.
That's a good one.
We've been going on about Tara Reid, but really, I think we just have cruel intentions.
but yeah, good one, Sir Walter.
Plenty of fun birthdays for November 8, but one more I just couldn't resist is someone no one's going to really know. His name is Colin Strauss. Okay. November 8, 1976, of the brothers Strauss. Colin and Greg are the directors of Aliens versus Predator Requiem.
Whoa.
The movie that came out December 25th on Christmas Day, no less, in 2007.
Christmas Day. I had to
mention it because we're going on an alien tangent, you know, from episode to episode. We just can't seem to escape this franchise. This movie stars Rako Aylesworth, who is... drum roll, please. Michelle Destler of 24. I mean, there are just so many parallels
God.
In this random factoid. So on brand for Squibbling Rivalry. So, I mean, you guys might not care for these, but I think they spark some fun.
Yeah, we've never even mentioned our love for 24. That's going to have to take a January turn, I think.
That's right. We started off November trudging through a dark dystopian future, and now we are looking towards the sun. Or are we?
We are
vampires. So November 8, I would just like to drop a couple more November 8 birthdays because there's some interesting ones today. And we're going to start all the way back in 1431 because Vlad the Impaler was born. And this, I don't know if you know, is... OG Dracula. By most accounts, Vlad III was born in 1431 in what is now Transylvania, the central region of modern-day Romania.
What? So he would drink people's blood?
See, I don't know that much about Vlad, but his nickname is the Impaler, so watch out. And I only thought it was fitting because is this a coincidence or is it crazy that Bram Stoker himself was born on this day in 1847, November 8th, the same day as Vlad the Impaler. And Vlad. Bram Stoker is the author of the original Dracula novel.
It goes all the way to the top.
I think it's all connected. And I think the only reason why I wanted to touch on that, other than it being a crazy coincidence, is that we were talking about our Spooky Oct films, and we kind of glossed over vampires because we... touched on, you know, how I Am Legend is in sort of a zombie vampire hybrid, and then we got into talking Twilight, and I think that just soured us on vampires in general. So I just want to mention briefly my favorite vampire flick, and I thought maybe I'd give you an opportunity to talk about one of the vampire movies that you like.
All right. Well, you know what? I don't know. I haven't seen it, but I want to, and I don't know now if it's actually vampires. 28 Days Later, or is that zombie?
That is zombies.
There's too many zombie ones out there. Yeah. I don't have any vampire love, I don't think.
Okay.
What's yours?
So, I mean, you could go OG Bram Stoker's Dracula, but that's, you know, there's the original from 1931 that was just called Dracula, and then they did a remake in 92. Mm. Big year for you, sis. I mean, Interview with the Vampire in 94 that had a star-studded cast, and it had your boy, Gary Oldman.
Oh, yeah.
But for me, my all-time favorite vampire film, and this is going to be no surprise to some, Blade. Blade, oh. Baby, 1998. It's the first Marvel comic book movie that kind of sat at the top as my favorite until we got X-Men in 2000 and, of course, Spider-Man in 2002.
Who's in Blade again?
That's Wesley Snipes. Darkness.
Wesley Snipes.
But yeah, so Blade is my favorite vampire film. So it's not your traditional vampire film by any sense, but I thought that they captured the essence of vampires not being able to look into the sun and being allergic to garlic and all those mm-hmm. classic tropes. And I just thought it was kind of fitting. I mean, I didn't know anything about the lore of Dracula, but the fact that his name was Vlad the Impaler and vampires...
That is such a coincidence. I can't believe that.
How do you kill a vampire? At the stake?
Yeah, that's why I'm like, was he... That's weird that he was called that. Because it sounds like he'd be killing the vampires.
Yeah.
So I don't think the person who made up his nickname.
And there's one film I've been meaning to check out, and that's Dracula Untold, but I still haven't seen it. It's kind of that alternate history of Dracula.
Oh, right. Is it like more recent?
Yeah, it's one of the more recent ones. But speaking of impaled, I happened to watch another movie featuring an impaler of sorts. The T-1000.
An impaler of sorts.
We mentioned in the previous episode that I watched The Terminator on Halloween, and I just couldn't get enough, especially knowing that Terminator Dark Fate is now out in theaters, and I'm definitely going to try and check that out soon, so I had to continue on with T2. But
I watched the OG last night.
Yeah, so you've caught the Terminator fever as well.
I have to say to you that I guess I agree with you that it is a scary movie from last time.
Oh, yeah.
I disagreed. It's pretty scary. He's like, other than the really, really horrible old-fashioned effects, when he has this like mechanical eye and it's like clearly a wax face, when he's like actually just himself driving and looking around, it's terrifying. He plays a very good cyborg.
Yeah, and I mean, it wasn't his first film. I think his first big sort of action film would have been Conan the Barbarian, but Arnold Schwarzenegger, it was definitely the first one I remember watching for him, so it was interesting that he kind of emerged on the scene as a villain, even though you could look at Conan as he's a typical hero in that one, but I don't think that's the one that stood out to most people. I think it's the Terminator in 1984. Mm-hmm. And of course it's a very different role from being a villain in 1984, and then fast forward to 1991,
mm-hmm.
when, you know, it's round two and he's coming for John Connor.
Yeah.
Or is he?
Well, yeah, I mean, no spoilers for me. Just kidding. I remembered that movie really differently because I probably haven't watched Terminator since, I don't know, I was 13 or something, and I honestly thought the love story was between the Terminator and Sarah Connor. I just remembered it all wrong.
Right.
So it was kind of like watching a new movie, which was really exciting. But yeah, it was definitely scary especially when he turned well into the cyborg after the fire at the end, and he just like would walk. Like the walking is so much scarier than the running. He never ran at anyone.
I agree. It's kind of like similar to a zombie film where they're not necessarily come at you super fast, but they're super scary.
Yeah, but you know they can do anything. And my biggest fear was like, I knew I was scared because I was planning my escapes if I was her, if I was Sarah Connor. And I was like, is he able to see through walls? Because, you know, this is a cyborg. Who knows what they can do? You're sitting there in the 80s and this person's just told you they've come back from the future. Who knows what they could do in the future? And I mean, that's another thing I want to talk about. Why do they go so near into the future in 80s movies? I feel like if we did now something that was in the future, it would be the year 3000.
I agree with you. You know, when you look at
I guess not, because Blade Runner 2049, but it's still a bit. I mean, it's still a bit.
Well, in that case, though, they're sitting in the same world as Blade Runner, so they can't go too far ahead of the 2019
era. Yeah, but
era.
If you were coming out with a brand new, like, this is in the future, I would think we'd be looking way further into the future. I just think our time perceptions have really changed.
I agree that with the technology we have now, if we were trying to imagine something super advanced, we'd probably go further into the future.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
But it's funny that, you know, these visions like the Terminator, that's 1984. And if you look at the novel 1984, which was obviously written a lot earlier, they were looking to 1984 to be that that futuristic sort of dystopian future, right?
So I know.
So it's all relative, I guess.
I know. I bet in like 1920, they were thinking 1930 is going to be, you know, like the whole different world. But I guess in ways like the last 100 years have been changing so quickly. So it's just interesting now. I feel like we live in this cold world where we just think we've seen it all, and something that's so exciting and different would have to be 1,000 years from now.
Yeah. So you watched the original, and growing up, do you remember T2 as being your favorite, or at least most memorable out of those two?
I don't think I ever saw T2. Ooh. This isn't stuff I liked when I was younger. That's so true. This is all new to me. Yeah, I there are things I did like, but I would not be that excited when you pulled up an action movie when I was like 12. So it's all very new for me. I never am thinking of my childhood as Terminator at all. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting to watch it now as such an old movie.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting. So I really kind of want to tread carefully knowing that you haven't watched it because...
Or I have, but it wouldn't have been something in my memory. It's not memorable.
But if it's not... So if it's not in your memory, then you're not sort of aware of the plot line.
Yeah, I didn't even know what was going to happen at the end of Terminator. I was...
Right. So that's exciting. So that means that we can kind of dive into T2... At another time, I might talk a little bit about it, but I'm going to avoid spoilers for you because I don't want to ruin your experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Back in my day, we actually covered T2 as one of the blockbusters that came out in 91, and we did discuss some of the twists inside of that and how it is something that you can only experience once. Like, you'll never get it back once you know. It's kind of like when you watch a movie like The Sixth Sense or The Others. Once you know... You know, right?
Yeah.
So it will be interesting to see how you take in T2 now that you've seen the original.
Yeah.
And I think that most people regard T2 as the better of the two. And that's just because, like, I just watched it, right? And it's definitely got that higher production value. It's got the more action-centric, like, the action set pieces are just bigger, louder, and more... cohesive, more like it, James Cameron is really coming into his own by 1991, and he's really nailing those action sequences. Mm-hmm. But where he kind of focuses more, just as he did with Aliens, he focuses more on the big action and the sort of blockbuster nature of the film. That's where you kind of lose out more on the horror. So there are horror elements inside of T2, but it's not like in the Terminator where it just feels like a horror movie from start to finish. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of action inside of that too. Don't get me wrong. But it's that horror of this unstoppable force. I compared it in the previous episode to Halloween. You know, Michael Myers, he's sort of a unstoppable force of nature.
Yeah.
That is just like, there's no emotion there. There's nothing you can do to stop him. He's just coming for you. And the only difference, of course, being... he's coming at you with guns versus knives.
In the 21st century, a weapon will be invented like no other. This weapon will be powerful, versatile, and indestructible. It can't be reasoned with. It can't be bargained with. It will feel no pity, no remorse, no pain. No fear. It will have only one purpose: to return to the present and prevent the future. This weapon will be called the Terminator.
You're dead, honey.
What day is it? The date?
12th May, Thursday.
What year?
The Terminator. Your future is in its hands.
Well, I agree because I was shocked. I guess just kind of going into it with not many expectations or not much knowledge of it, that everyone was just getting shot down. And I was going over it to Louis and I was like, oh my God, what? People are just dying. So that's horror movie element when people are just dying. There's no, it doesn't matter who the character is or anything.
Yeah, like everyone died. What are your thoughts on that scene when he shows up at the police station? Like, how did you take that in? Like, what?
Because it was scary because I was like, which room is she in? Which room is he in? When's he going to find her? And actually, the whole time I was just thinking, just crawl up into the vent. I was basically just trying to find ways for her to hide. And right. That was what, going back to what I was saying before, actually, I veered off. I was like, can he see through the walls? Does he know where she is by looking? Because you see his vision tells him all this information as a cyborg. But does it go behind a wall being like saying she's in there, Sarah Connor in there?
I think he can see the heat signatures, but he wouldn't necessarily be able to discern her from everyone else
behind
a wall.
So you couldn't hide behind a desk like she does. You couldn't hide up an event. He'll sense that you're there.
Yeah, that's her instinct, but I think eventually he's going to get you. Like the only way you could do is really run, right? Like you can run, but you can't hide, kind of thing.
Yeah.
You can sort of, he'll just keep coming. It's like, it's kind of like the zombie thing. It's kind of like, it's that, like I said, force of nature. He just, he can't be stopped.
Yeah. Oh man. And he's huge. Was he voted biggest man or something at that time? Was he? I think that was a thing.
Well, I equate. So.
Or strongest man, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, he was a bodybuilder through and through, and he actually was bigger when he was doing his strongman, like, pumping iron videos and stuff. When he entered Hollywood, I think he had to cut down.
Wow.
But he was still massive in that first one.
So funny, when he goes up to those three teenagers or young guys.
Did you notice who one of them was?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, no, now I'm forgetting. I was...
It's our boy Bill Paxton.
From what?
Okay, so rest in peace, Bill Paxton. We lost you too soon. But he's such a funny guy, and he's been in so many great things. And he's also been with Arnold inside of True Lies. You might remember him as the slime ball in True Lies, who is trying to court his wife because his wife wants to have that kind of secret agent experience that he kind of fabricates for her.
And then
he gets Arnold real jealous.
Yeah. I knew I recognized someone, but now I'm...
Well, I mean, in 1984, he's just like a punk kid. He's got like the blue mohawk.
He's got the blue hair. Yeah.
He's the one who tries to like point the switchblade.
What kind of...
Arnold.
It's that's the most... Out of this whole movie, that's clearly not realistic. That is the least realistic scene. What kind of kids would look at this massive naked man and not run the hell away?
Well, you know, I mean, stupid kids, the invincible, you know.
But this is the biggest, strongest guy you've ever seen.
Yeah, I know. And I think it just goes back to like they can't believe who would be naked in the streets in the 80s. Like,
yeah,
just walking around naked, like you're clearly something's wrong with you. So like they're just thinking that I don't know, that they know better. Maybe.
Yeah. I was also thinking that Reese at the beginning.
It's also mob mentality. There's three of them. I think they
could
beat him
up. Yeah,
that's
true. I think they could. That's so funny.
But yeah, The Terminator. It opens up year 2029. We are literally 10 years away from the year of darkness, where sentient machines hell-bent on exterminating all humans have sent a cyborg assassin back to 1984 to wipe out the leader of the resistance before he is even born.
And you know what? That's not happening yet. I find these futuristic movies so crazy because have we become almost like ignorance is bliss? Because in the 80s, they were fine saying, yep, in 30 years. I know this is not, it's not like people thought this was actually going to happen, but movies do reflect what people believe is going to happen to the world,
well,
even if
it
it's
plays
fiction.
Off people's fears. Yeah. Obviously, it has to be somewhat believable.
Yeah, sorry, fear what's going to happen, not believe. But it's interesting. And now... are there movies in the last 2 years that say there's gonna be like nuclear, like what was it in Terminator that happened? It was like nuclear.
Yeah, well, so once Skynet goes online within Cyberdyne systems, basically becomes self-aware.
Yeah.
And then launches, gets its hand onto all the nuclear warheads and launches.
So essentially they were, you know, that's reflecting fear that that could happen so soon. And then now we don't really have movies like that, I feel like. Now it's more like Zombie, which, I don't know, is that the fear or...
It could be. I mean, everything is sort of relative to what's going on in the political climate too, right? So, I mean, like that threat of nuclear war was always a big thing during like the Cold War and, you know, just not knowing which, is one country going to snap and launch one of their nukes and then cause a nuclear holocaust? But
isn't that still a fear? It's just no one's making movies about it.
I just feel like nowadays it's less about that and it's more about... I mean,
maybe it's more social things now. Like a lot of movies have a lot of social factors they never used to at all.
Yeah,
they had no focus on that.
I agree.
Which is cool.
And there are trends, like the zombie trend is still pretty big, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so for the Terminator, so now we got to get you to watch Judgment Day. So it's interesting. So 1984, and then by the time we hit Judgment Day, even though the movie came out in 1991. It's set in 95. And Judgment Day itself is supposed to occur on 1997.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So they didn't really go... What a weird choice to say, is this just 5 years from now? Like, instead of...
I think they want you to think that basically if the struggle that's happening between the heroes of the story is like... is going to be believable, then it has to be imminent. Like, if we don't stop the Terminator, the world's going to end.
Mm.
In like a very short amount of time, not 20 years from now, but like, mm-hmm. you know. And that's the thing, is it's interesting about sort of this whole time travel aspect to it, is that it's the constant struggle between fate, as in the choices you make, maybe as like mankind, the choices that they make, is that an inevitability, or can you make the right choices to avoid a dark fate, or is it just delaying the inevitable? Are you inevitably gonna head down that dark path, or is there something you can do? And that's the constant reverberating question, and that it'll be interesting to see how they tackle it again in a third installment, because the whole reason why I'm sort of fascinated with the Terminator right now is because, funny enough, with Halloween. So Halloween came out in 1978, but then had a whole string of sequels, and I didn't even watch them all. Like,
no, there were so crazy. Many.
There was like Halloween H2O, and then like all these, like Rob Zombie was doing them, and now Jamie Lee Curtis is back. She was the titular hero in the first one. It was like that classic slasher film.
Mm-hmm.
And they made one last year. I don't know why they didn't title it Halloween 2, but essentially the idea behind it was, this is a direct sequel to 1978's Halloween. So we're going to ignore everything else. We're going to go forward and make this one, which takes place years in the future, with Jamie Lee Curtis reprising her role.
Wow.
And Michael Myers is back for some more carnage. So... That's an interesting idea, because, you know, we're in a culture inside of the film industry that is always making sequels, always making remakes, reboots. It's something that it doesn't seem we're going to be able to avoid, because if something's proven that it can make money, then they're going to find a way to bring it back or to capitalize on the profitability of like a strong IP such as Terminator or Halloween. So it's an interesting concept of, okay, we realized we made some that didn't really do well critically or didn't go over well with the fans. So we're actually going to go back to the drawing board and make a sequel to one of our earlier ones. So the original one.
Yeah,
so
that's
kind of
smart.
What they're doing with Terminator Dark Fate. That's the reason why we're looking at the original in 1984. We're going to get you to watch T2 Judgment Day and see if that will carry forward and be something, because I don't know Dark Fate if it's going to be good or bad, or if I'm going to take to it like I did with the first two. But they are making this one. They're ignoring the rest, like Terminator 3, Terminator Salvation, Terminator Genesis. All of those are going out the window, and Terminator Dark Fate is a direct sequel to T2 Judgment Day in 1991. So, I mean, yeah, it's out in theaters now, and hopefully we'll get to go check it out and decide for ourselves if we are indeed going to end up in the year of darkness, 2029 AD. So, yeah, so get on board with us. Watch the first two Terminators. Go check out Dark Fate, and we'll have a good conversation about that.
I'll be back.
We are going to be checking out a new series next week, and that is...
Mandalorian.
The Mandalorian. We have new Star Wars coming at us, and it's not even in the form of Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. We also have a brand new live-action series, the first of its kind, and it's coming out on Disney Plus on November 12th.
Wow. And wait, so how many episodes will it be?
I think it's sort of a 8 to 10 episode season.
All coming out at once?
So that's the thing. So they're going to be, as far as I know, they're going to be avoiding the binge culture and releasing them week to week. But I think because they're excited to launch on November 12th, they might be releasing either two episodes for The Mandalorian or like the first one's like 2 hours or something. I think that they're going to release at least 2 hours of The Mandalorian so that it can get everyone buzzing about it. Mm-hmm. And then it'll be week to week. And I think it's done after 8 episodes, but they are going to go forward. Some of the Marvel and Star Wars series in the live action world that they're releasing are going to be limited series, but The Mandalorian is going to be, I think, one of their flagship ones that they're going to carry forward into season 2 and hopefully 3 and beyond. So it'll be fun to check that out, because The Mandalorian, it's kind of going back to the OGOT, which
yeah,
is the
like last main night
original trilogy, right?
Last night I may have dabbled in The Last Jedi.
Oh, did you? The Last Jedi?
Oh, no, sorry. Return of the Jedi.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I was thinking of The Last Jedi because I was wondering if... So do you think that if we watch The Return of the Jedi and then we watch all 10 episodes of Mandalorian and then we watch The Force Awakens, that's going to be seamless?
Okay, so that's a good question. Similar to how...
Or do you think Mandalorian is going to just be alongside Force Awakens?
I want to say the timings. Mandalorian is about 5 to 8 years following the events of Return of the Jedi. So mm-hmm. we're going to be looking at a galaxy that's not quite right yet. Because remember, The Force Awakens, I think it occurs 30 years from Return of the Jedi. Mm. So that's a big chunk of time where evil has found its way to crawl back mm-hmm. into a position of some power anyways with the First Order. Mm-hmm. But this will be a different side of the Empire, because they're not gone. They just got defeated, but they're running scared and they're on the outskirts in the Outer Rim.
Yeah.
So there's still some sinister activity going on with some of these, I guess, generals and admirals or whoever is still out there who didn't get taken down during the Return of the Jedi or even like the fall of the Battle of Jakku. Mm-hmm. So, you know how in Force Awakens how there's all those downed Star Destroyers and you see Rey and she's scavenging?
Cause yeah,
they
yeah.
They had this big battle even after Return of the Jedi to like finally sort of snuff out the Empire. And we don't really know. I mean, there are canon junkies out there who will chime in, I'm sure, and correct me, because I'm sticking to sort of what we know from the movies.
Yeah.
We don't really know how that went down, how long after Return of the Jedi. You know, mm-hmm. there's still Empire lurking out there in the galaxy. It's going to be interesting to see how the Mandalorian, who's like this bounty hunter-looking figure who looks like Boba Fett.
Yeah.
And we don't know much about him, but he's wearing the Mandalorian armor, and he's kind of, we don't know if he's a good guy, we don't know if he's a bad guy. It'll be interesting to see how he, like, interacts with either heroes or villains inside of Star Wars.
Yeah, I think it'll tell us more of that story then. That'll be really interesting.
Yeah, so that'll be cool. So you watched Return of the Jedi. So was there anything that stood out to you that was just like, oh, I'm so happy that, like, you know, we're we're still getting Star Wars, or
well,
that I'm
yeah,
still
I mean,
kind of living in this world.
Yeah, of course. Well, everything. But yeah, there. I mean, we were talking a little bit before about the newer edits, which are a bit strange, but I do kind of like. Like, it was weird, the music in Jabba's kind of like club. Where it, like,
yeah, like you're talking about the special edition.
Yeah, just
right?
addition, like yeah. these additions they've made. And, you know, now that's just the way the movie is. So I wonder, people that are just growing up and starting getting into Star Wars, like, I just feel like it kind of is. I wonder if it hinders their like ability to fall for this whole series, because already for someone who's 13, right now, total like Gen Z, like they already see it as an old movie. But then when you have like an old movie with slightly old, like newer but still old additions,
yeah,
like you were we were talking about the weird 90s music that we're confused about what the style is,
for sure.
Is that going to put people off that are really young? I'm not sure. But anyway, I do love like the Jabba scene. And I was wondering what you think, like when you first saw it, is Jabba scary to you? Is he a scary character?
So that is an interesting point that you made, because when I was first thinking about the special editions, it was coming from a place of, I've already seen the original, so it doesn't
yeah,
really,
exactly.
As much as it might be like off-putting to see that some of the changes and some of the choices that Lucas made after the fact, it's like I still have the memories of how it went down originally, and then this is just kind of like bonus stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't really, as much as I like to make fun of some of it, it doesn't affect like how I feel about the franchise. But you're right. If someone's experiencing it for the first time, that's all they have, because the originals aren't really available unless you find like an old copy somewhere. So it's.
I just realized that they probably wouldn't even know that they're from two different time periods. Someone who's really that young probably just thinks, oh, this is all old from one time. So it might yeah. not affect it at all. It might just
that's
be, oh, great old
too.
Movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so,
it might just be us
yeah,
nerds.
And so you were asking how I felt about the...
I just wonder, at Jabba the Hutt as a character...
Oh, right.
Do you find him scary? Did you find him scary when you first... Obviously, now, probably not, but...
I think as know. A kid, Jabba was scary. I mean, he's pretty gross. And in Return of the Jedi, I mean, that was the first time I was introduced to him. He definitely has that... you know, he's a... He's not CGI. He's a... he is sort of a prop.
Is it claymation? No. Because there's a bit of claymation in Star Wars.
Yeah, he's not CGI. He's more, he has like that visceral kind of grimy look to him.
Yeah.
And it's funny because when you go back now and you watch the special editions, you get that scene in A New Hope. So you're actually introduced to him a lot earlier and in a much campier sort of, oh, I'm going to get you, Han Solo, kind of way. Like it's not as menacing. And
way more laughy and high.
Yeah, more like, oh, you killed Greedo. Oh, I'm going to get you.
Yeah,
you better come through with the money. Like, in Return of the Jedi, I feel like he's way more like, oh, there's a lot on the line here. Like, if, you know, one wrong move and you're in the Rancor pit, you know?
So. And it's just less is more in Return of the Jedi. He really doesn't even say much. Most of his henchmen talk for him, and he's just there gross, and then like laughs about how he's gonna just kill you with the Rancor. Like
it's
very less is more, so it is a bit scary, but I just think it's too weird for me to be, I think he's too weird and gross looking for me to be like scared of him.
But it's an interesting... I mean, he is a little dated in terms of aesthetic, but at the same time I think it's just the whole like the fact that you're in the underbelly, like, you know, the capital of scum and villainy, it seems, at Jabba's palace, and just like everyone seems like they are out to get you. The whole thing, it definitely has a darker feel than A New Hope. And there's some, I mean, that sequence, they're on Tatooine, I think, for the first like at least half hour of the film. So it's not just like a glimpse of Jabba. It's like you're sitting in his world for a little.
Yeah, it's true. Oh my god, it's so funny, that part where they Is it Luke that's about to be executed, or is it Han?
So it's both, because Leia is still the slave in her gold bikini.
I hate her as a slave. That grosses me out. I'm sure
it... As much as it does gross even me out as a like a concept, it does give her the opportunity to overcome that adversity.
Yeah.
She gets the best of Jabba in the end, right?
Totally.
It's not someone saving her. It's back to the roots of... I maintain this. She may be named Princess Leia, but she's not just a princess. She's a hero.
She changes the definition of princess.
Yeah, exactly. Like in A New Hope, the very first time you encounter Princess Leia, she's blasting a stormtrooper.
Yeah, like totally. Out of the hall. Like, she's badass. Yeah. But I love that scene. They do a really funny, Family Guy does all the Star Wars episodes.
I love those.
They do the funniest, like everyone looks at each other with the plan of we're gonna get out of this. That last moment, it's like boom, and they look boom, and it's like trumpets. But in Family Guy, they like obviously drag it out, and it'll be like everyone looks at each other or at someone 80 times, and it's like a 10-minute scene.
Yeah,
Every time I watch it now in Return of the Jedi, I'm just like thinking of that. I can't separate them.
Yeah, so I mean, it's both, but Han is still sort of blinded from the Tiglo Carbonite, and Luke. So they're both supposed to walk the plank into the Sarlacc pit. Of course, R2-D2 comes in with the assist, and shoots the lightsaber over to Luke, so he can start fighting everybody off. And then, of course, Han gets his moment with Boba Fett. And it's kind of comical in the way that Boba goes out into the Sarlacc pit. So I don't know. I like that whole sequence. I mean, I still maintain that out of the three movies, Empire Strikes Back is my favorite. But the action inside of Return of the Jedi is like there's echoes from A New Hope, but it's like it really is that bigger and better sequel, if that makes sense. Like, maybe the themes they don't resonate as much as maybe A New Hope or Empire Strikes Back, but the actual action and spectacle is on the tippy top.
Tippy top. And is that the biggest role Lando plays in all six films?
Well, so he had the sort of on the fence role in Empire Strikes Back, and now he's kind of like, general in the rebellion, and see him, leading the charge in the space battle. I love that too about Return of the Jedi. Just how it's like this multifaceted epic where you've got multiple things going on at the same time. You've got the space battle up top. You've got the battle for Endor to take down the shield generator for the new Death Star. And then, of course, you've got that more internal struggle between Luke, Darth Vader, and, of course, Emperor Palpatine.
Ugh.
Dark side.
Palpatine is gross.
He is my favorite character.
I just can't stand his face. He's just like Thanos. It's just a gross, evil face to look at.
Such a great villain. Ian McDermott just crushes in that role. I don't know. Like, there's, like we were saying before, how Darth Vader is the deadliest force in the galaxy until you're in the Emperor and you realize
who the real master. Darth Vader's not scary. He instantly stops being scary when Palpatine enters.
Yeah, he's sort of reduced to his apprentice.
Yeah,
his minion.
And you realize so much. It's that maybe he doesn't really, really, truly to his core believe all this, but Palpatine does. Like, he is evil to the core. He's the dark side.
100%.
And then he realized Darth Vader could have been the light side.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons why I go back to Revenge of the Sith, and I love some of the themes inside of there, because it sets up Anakin to be, yes, he turns into Darth Vader, but you realize the motivation behind it, the reason why he goes along with Palpatine, and then he kind of just feels hopeless and stuck after everything's failed, and that it's really all he has left.
Yeah.
So it's just it's really crazy to watch that transformation, and then to see, fast forward to when Luke is a young teenage farm boy on Tatooine, and Darth Vader's like the sort of what would you call it, the uh the spear of the Empire, like the one that's kind of cutting through
the enforcer.
Yeah, he's basically the galaxy's enforcer. He's Emperor Palpatine's enforcer. You don't even really know. You know that there's an emperor.
Yeah, exactly. You know that this he is answers when he's to scariest. Somebody,
but they don't really touch on that until you get to Return of the Jedi. So,
welcome, young Skywalker. I have been expecting you. You no longer need those. Guards, leave us. I'm looking forward to completing your training. In time, you will call me Master.
You're gravely mistaken. You won't convert me as you did my father.
Oh no, my young Jedi. You will find that it is you who are mistaken about a great many things.
His lightsaber.
Yes. A Jedi's weapon. Much like your father's. By now you must know your father can never be turned from the dark side. So will it be with you.
You're wrong. Soon I'll be dead. And you with me.
Perhaps you referred to the imminent attack of your rebel fleet.
Yes. I assure you, we are quite safe from your friends here.
Your overconfidence is your weakness.
Your faith in your friends is yours.
It is pointless to resist, my son.
Everything that has transpired has done so according to my design. Your friends up there on the Sanctuary Moon are walking into a trap, as is your rebel fleet. It was I who allowed the Alliance to know the location of the shield generator. It is quite safe from your pitiful little band. An entire legion of my best troops awaits them. Oh, I'm afraid the deflector shield will be quite operational when your friends arrive.
And then cut to Return of the Jedi when he gets the helmet off. The saddest, grossest part of the whole
thing. Oh, yeah.
I just can't stand seeing him on the inside of the helmet. It's so horrible.
Yeah. That's a great moment. And then, of course, that's the big redemption. And most people will say, well, how can you redeem Darth Vader? I mean, he's murdered so many people. He's just an evil guy. He killed younglings in Revenge of the Sith. Redemption for me is not necessarily in the eyes of the rest of the galaxy. I'm pretty sure everyone still condemns Darth Vader for what he did. It's more so just the redemption of, there's still a human side to this monster.
Of course, yeah.
And that Luke was able to get that closure or that resolution with his father.
Exactly. It's not for everyone. I don't think anyone else would have cared. No. Yeah.
And that's the thing. So, like, the Death Star gets blown up and sort of you've got Luke and Darth Vader and Emperor Palpatine all on the Death Star as it gets blown up. And it was an interesting conversation. We just recently were talking about it on Back in My Day. But there are those that feel that Luke's presence in Return of the Jedi is, at least in the third act, is sort of inconsequential as far as the galaxy is concerned, as far as saving the galaxy. It contrasts that to his role in A New Hope, where he's the one who's taking out the Death Star because he's flying the X-Wing and using the Force and nailing that epic shot into the reactor core. So what are your thoughts on that? Is that something that you think you identify with, or you think his role is still pivotal inside of Return of the Jedi?
Oh, sorry, Luke's?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, sorry. Well, yeah, I was just thinking about how when he actually goes, it is pivotal, but it kind of turns into like more his biography story. It's like he goes with Darth Vader to Palpatine. I think that part was really scary. It's like, wait, what are you gonna do? You aren't gonna go to the dark side.
And you're leaving your friend.
Yeah, it kind of turned
the opposite of what happens in Empire Strikes Back, right? Where he leaves his training to go help his friends.
So
now he's going back to what really started his journey in the first place.
Yeah, but I think by answering the question of pivotal, I don't think at all. Well, I don't think, because everyone else is fighting. And then the storyline just shows to him his storyline that's much more calm and like kind of discovery and like, am I going to go to the dark side? But he's not going to. So I think it's more the writers and directing choices that's like, well, why even focus on that? But I think it's because he's always the main character. He's like the Harry Potter. He needs to we need to go down that path. So no, I don't think it's as pivotal.
Well, as Obi-Wan would say, from a certain point of view. Because I always look at it as, okay, sure, you've got the galaxy, the fate of the galaxy is on the line, and maybe he's not the one pulling the trigger to end the biggest threat, which you could argue is the new Death Star, because it's fully operational and has the ability to take out planets.
Yeah.
But I would also say that on top of his motivation to turn his father back towards the light, he is... At the same time, and I mentioned this before, is taking the two biggest players off the board in terms of, you know, in A New Hope, you get Darth Vader. He's going to get in his personalized TIE fighter and he's going to make sure that these rebels don't mess with the Death Star. He would have been out there fighting had he not been dealing with this more cerebral sort of battle of souls and trying to...
Yeah.
Sort of, because really what it comes down to is who's going to bring balance to the Force, and are we going to get into the nitty gritty of what that means to fall into temptation, or, you know, stay towards the light, or, you know, pull back towards the light. And it's that whole light side, dark side struggle. And so that, I think, is almost just as important as the grandiose battles that are happening around them, because it's really a question at the end of the day of, you know, are you going to be able to save? And it's a similar question inside of the Terminator franchise. Can you save the soul of humanity? Can you come out the other side and survive at the end of the day? Or are you going to be swallowed up by either an army of machines or, you know, the dark side of the Force.
Yeah, you're right. I think every situation needs a leader. So I think it is important, of course, for him to be going doing that. Yeah, everyone can fight, and then maybe they can ruin the Death Star, destroy it. But then, like, someone needs to be leading on what do we do next, or maybe we can work together, find balance, like you say. So maybe that needs to be Luke. So I don't think it wasn't, like I said, I don't think it was pivotal, but I just mean in the concept of destroying the Death Star. No, but it is pivotal for overall. Yeah. You need a leader, and obviously the leader can't really be the one fighting. I think so too.
I think it just lends to that whole prophecy of, okay, maybe it didn't fulfill the way they thought it would with Anakin being the chosen one, and they thought that he was going to bring balance from like a positive, you know, from being a positive force throughout the galaxy.
So sad.
But in the end, he fulfills the prophecy because his son was able to get him to overthrow the Emperor. And so it still ends up achieving the balance that they were all sort of hoping to achieve.
Well, not really. I guess we're going to see in Mandalorian.
Well, yes. And so, you know, spoilers for Last Jedi, but I was just going to touch on the fact that you see that throne room sequence right before it pops off, that epic lightsaber battle with Snoke's guards.
Mm-hmm.
You see how Snoke is so powerful, yet Kylo Ren was able to fool him in terms of, he was so convinced that Kylo Ren was following his every will. Like, okay, you're going to take Rey out now, and I can see you doing it in your mind, and Kylo Ren's playing him on both sides and ends up taking Snoke out. But that's because Snoke his lust for power, his fixation on the dark side, and just being overconfident, really. I mean, that's kind of where the Emperor is at the end, where he just thinks he knows best, and he thinks he has foreseen everything, and he thinks that Luke is going to succumb to the dark side, and, you know.
Yeah, because it's almost like history repeats itself.
Yeah, it's like he thinks he knows best, and really, Luke is distracting him and his father, Darth Vader, and while he's distracting these big bads, the rebellion's able to take care of business the rest of the fight. So I think it's an interesting perspective for those who think that Luke has sort of gone the way of maybe Indiana Jones inside of the third act of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where many people think that had he not even been involved, the third act would have played out the way it did inside of Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is an interesting question for another time.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that I really buy that Luke's presence inside of Return of the Jedi, the culmination of the original Star Wars trilogy, is inconsequential. That's just not really how I feel about it. But interesting conversation nonetheless. And so
I have a side question. I zoned out thinking about if Luke and Sarah Connor were related in real life. They look the same.
Linda Hamilton, Mark Hamill.
I know, and that's what I was saying. I was like, Hamilton, they're both Hamilton, because I was thinking Hamill was Hamilton. Anyway, maybe they're cousins.
Yeah, and then I guess the only other thing too, because Empire Strikes Back being my favorite, and of course the big reveal inside of that was, no, I am your father. How do you feel about the reveal inside of Return of the Jedi that Yoda and Obi-Wan sort of discuss with Luke?
Oh, yeah, about his sister and confirming that, yes, he's his father.
So he's not the only Skywalker, and technically there's another that can, there's another hope that can restore.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what everyone wants. Like, everyone wants Han Solo and Leia to be together.
Right.
And I think there was like a little question mark earlier on. I can't remember which film.
Oh, A New Hope. The beginning of Empire Strikes Back is when she sort of kisses Luke on the lips to make Han jealous.
Yeah, yeah. But that's not even a question mark. But like,
again, I've said it many times. I go back to the fact that neither of the characters knew that they were brother sister, and you know, as gross as that is, she was not doing it out of feelings for Luke. She was doing it out of feelings for Han. So
of course, no, exactly. But I think it's just more of this, like, it really works. I think it's a satisfying storyline plot thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I like finding that out. I think that was a really good scene. Also, so sad about Yoda.
I know. We lost Yoda, but I love how every time we see Yoda inside of Star Wars, he's schooling people on failure. I just love that theme of failure that keeps sort of echoing throughout each trilogy.
Yeah.
So it was great. So, yeah, we're definitely ready for The Mandalorian, everybody. Everyone should be getting on board. Do your rewatches, because whether you're excited for Mandalorian or Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, it's all coming to a head this November, December. So let's get talking Star Wars.
Woo!
Squibbling Rivalry. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Squibblings. The podcast is Squibbling Rivalry and can be found across all your podcast platforms. Thanks again.
See you soon, everyone.